Conversations about race, diversity, ethnicity, well, they're not always easy, and they're often emotionally charged. But conversations about difficult issues are crucial in our society. It's this show and this network, it's what we're all about. More and more, though, individuals are taking advantage of today's technology to stage such conversations in a way that reaches an audience beyond the participants. Using media to bridge gaps and build community is our topic today on the West Side. And good morning. I'm Dean Kallenbach. Coming up a little later in the program, we'll be talking with Eric Schubring of WOJB, a radio station licensed to the Lakota Ray Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, and with Mary Zimmerman, communication manager for the City of River Falls, about a new initiative that community is implementing aimed to slow community spread of COVID-19. For the next several minutes, though, we'll be talking to Salika Duxworth-Lawton. She is a history and women's and gender and sexuality studies professor at UW-Eau Claire. She's president of Uniting Bridges Community Organization of the Chippewa Valley, and she's resident panelist and sometime host of the program Conversations in Color, and that's what we'll be talking with her about today. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, welcome back to the West Side.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I appreciate being here.
Good to have you. And also with us, Sheng Elizabeth Lohr. She's a social worker for Eau Claire County, and she's the founder and executive producer and host of a podcast called The Social Exchange Project. And Sheng Elizabeth Lohr, great to have you along today.
Thank you so much, Dean, for having me.
So if you have questions for our guests or thoughts about the outgrowth of these programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our number is 800-228-5615, 800-228-5615. Our email address is ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. So let's talk about the advent of both of the programs that you folks are involved in today. And Salika Duxworth-Lawton, let's start with you. Talk about how Conversations in Color got started.
Well, it got started after Juneteenth. Ed Hudgens and I were talking, and Ed really, I want to give him credit. He came up to the idea and said, you know, we need a radio program. We need to have these conversations that we're having at Acoustic Cafe in front of people. And people were coming up and joining in these conversations. But what we were both committed to was having the conversations in a civil, respectful way. Because what we're seeing on the internet are people just name-calling and not listening and not hearing, sort of combative conversations where they're just either trying to one-up each other or insult each other. We wanted conversations that move community forward, but where we can talk about these very difficult subjects in a space where people knew they would not be attacked. And Conversations in Color was born from that. It started off as two specials and then wound up, it's now a show. And we were happy to bring Sheng in for multiple shows. When we she's always been planned to be a co-host / resident panelist like me, and we want to build up that position so that we'll have people there with expertise but who are also part of the community, who are open and listening and giving, so that we can have the kind of conversation you'd have around your table.
And you mentioned it started out as a couple of specials and has evolved into a series. More evidence that no good idea goes unpunished, right?
Yes. Yeah. Although, I mean, we've been very blessed. I mean, we now have Dr. Roderick Jones, who is helping us from the University's College of Education. We've got A.J. Moen from the Pablo. We have Adam Akola from CoLab. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to get some amazing guests on. And we want to take advantage of Zoom to, we still want to be based in the Chippewa Valley, But we also want to talk to people who are outside the Chippewa Valley, in part looking at this rural-urban divide, to talk about how we bridge it.
Yeah. So that's the conversation about Conversations in Color. Sheng Elizabeth Lohr, let's talk about the program you host called the Social Exchange Project. How did that get going?
You know, I joke about this a lot because it actually started out just being a fun kind of interaction between my friend Addie and I, and it evolved into something much, much more. We started this podcast really kind of lightheartedly, wanting, you know, a platform to provide for our friends, so our musician friends and people in the community that we felt had a voice that needed to be heard. And as I looked around Eau Claire, I realized that there wasn't a lot of podcasts that really offer that video, the 4K quality. And we're like, why not just do something like that? And so my background is in psychology, specifically positive psychology. And I did a lot of research focusing on strengths. And I wanted something that I could provide to our community that would offer something to give back to our Hmong community. And so really, I focus a lot on entertainment, education, and impact. So when I say entertainment, obviously that would be comedians, musicians, educational. We've had Dr. Salika on the show as well, and we love her absolutely so much. But we will have professors just like Dr. Kongfing Pa from the university, and then impact. So we focus a lot on social issues as well. So it started out really just kind of lightheartedly, and it just became something so much more. And I absolutely love doing it.
We're talking with Sheng Elizabeth Lohr, the voice you just heard. She's with the Social Exchange Project podcast. And Salika Duxworth-Lawton, who's involved in the Conversations in Color program. If you would like to join our conversation about those programs, now's the time to do it. 800-228-5615. That's 800-228-5615. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. So both of your programs launched within the past year or so. Talk about how they've changed, how they've evolved from your first episode to the most recent one. And Sheng, let's start with you about the Social Exchange Project.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, it started out with us just not really having a lot of idea and structure on how each episode was going to go. Now I spend a lot of time preparing for each of the episodes and the content. For me, I want to maximize the time that my guests are on the show. So I will do a lot of research beforehand, and I actually handpick the individuals that come on the show. So how it has evolved is that I'm looking for something with more depth in terms of what I want to provide the Hmong community and the Eau Claire or Chippewa Valley community. So I will oftentimes think of more thought-provoking, deeper questions that I ask my guests. Versus just like, you know, how did you get started in your career? It's more of like, tell me about how you felt when, you know, this situation happened. You know, we talked a lot about some of the issues, you know, earlier this year with George Floyd and COVID-19. And so I do try to delve in a little bit deeper so that I can offer my guests, you know, the content that is unique to them, but also offer our viewers and our listeners with something too that they can take away and say, well, that was a very thought-provoking or a very in-depth conversation that we had about race, or that we had about the Hmong culture, or that we had about just this individual struggles with their mental health. And so that's how I feel I would like the show to continue onwards, is to continue to dive in a little bit deeper on specific issues that pertain to that guest, but still have it be relevant to the individuals listening.
And speaking of the individuals listening, you used a phrase within that answer to the Hmong community and to the greater Chippewa Valley community or something like that. What is your target for the program?
You know, I went back and forth a lot about this. Like, I had to... I had to get a lot of help, actually, because my background is not at all in business. And I realized there was a lot of business that came with starting a podcast. And I did a lot of work in taking classes and courses and things. And that was one of the questions, was who is your target audience? And I thought a lot about it. And what I really want is Midwest base, you know, as one of the tiers. So individuals from this area, I want to focus locally on musicians, locally on, you know, our professors, locally on life coaches here. But then also I wanted it to be more specifically aimed towards my community. So the Hmong community, I feel that we have a lot more modern issues now that we can have different topics of discussions that normally or traditionally is not represented. And so that was something that was really, really important to me. So I would say Midwest based, but then also specifically aimed towards the Hmong community.
Salika Duxworth-Lawton, there have been over a dozen conversations in color so far. Talk about some of the conversations from this past year that you found particularly important or interesting.
Well, I think that the defund the police one and the one with Chief Rokas was particularly important. But I think the one that we just did about how racism hurts white people. And we got a lot of questions on that one. We actually had questions coming in from Georgia and California for the first time. So we, even though we're focusing in the Chippewa Valley, we are reaching outside. And I felt that it was really important for white people to see that discriminating against other people hurts them. That these ideas of supremacy, these ideas of discrimination, these ideas of these abusive ideas and stereotypes about race backfire and hurt the majority as well as the scapegoated minority.
Now we have a
so
clip.
So to have, and in this case, it was Teresa O'Halloran, who's now the interim vice chancellor for EDI, Joe Abholt, who's the former dean of students at UWEC and now is a trauma psychologist in private practice, and Dale Peters, the former city manager, talking about how these stereotypes hurt us and the Chippewa Valley. I think that was really powerful. I think that was one of the best, not just the best shows that we did, but one of the most important shows we've done.
We do have a clip from the one you mentioned regarding police conduct and the Defund the Police movement. The particular clip is an exchange between you, Salika, and one of the other panelists, Eau Claire County Sheriff Ron Kramer. Can you set the stage for us a little bit about this program and as we go into this clip? Go ahead.
Well, we had Sheriff Ron Kramer from Eau Claire County. We had Eric Atkinson from the city of Menominee. He's the chief at city of Menominee and Chief Matt Rokas from Eau Claire. And we were talking about the racial imbalance in the jail and the fact that there are some people who use that as an excuse to reinforce stereotypes of Black people. And I pointed out that geography, particularly our proximity to I-94 was a problem, but also that one of the practices, cash bail, was a problem. So he was making the point that he didn't feel it was a disparate practice towards Blacks in the Valley.
All right, let's take a listen to the clip. This is from Conversations in Color. Salika Duxworth-Lawton and Eau Claire County Sheriff Ron Kramer.
So I think part of what we're dealing with up here is we have less segregation. But on the other hand, too, for the Black community, the fact that the jail has an overage is not well explained to our community as these are not Black people who originate in Eau Claire. Because if you take out the people who originate from, say, Chicago and Minneapolis, how many, what would the percentage of Blacks in your jail be then?
It'd be a lot lower, and I'm glad you brought that up. I missed the point. Eau Claire's population is 1.9 total of African American color. And someone did a snapshot one day of our jail, and it was 19%. And they want to correlate that to the police are targeting the Black community. Well, I told Salika, go on our website. Every name is published that's in our county jail, and compare it to CCAP. It's not their first time. second time, third time they're in our jail. They probably have been criminal histories from Minnesota, criminal histories from Chicago. They were here committing crime, got caught. So the judge put them on a cash bond for the flight risk and for the criminal history that the person had.
So you had three law enforcement leaders on the panel talking frankly about those issues. What was your goal in building that particular show?
We wanted to talk honestly about what's happening, but we also wanted to correct a number of stereotypes. And there is controversy in the law enforcement community about the ideas of the no-knock raids. In that particular clip, we were talking about the fact that most of those people that they're holding in the jail, they're getting off of I-94. And people don't realize that our jail services 100 to 150 mile area. But it also starts us discussing what are effective police methods. And we were talking about that. And we were talking about the Memphis method, which is evidence-based policing versus killology, and how police here are trained versus how police in Milwaukee are trained. One of the biggest issues we've had with people here who have criticized the protesters is the idea that our police are good. Why are you protesting here? And to talk about this is how our police are trained, but recognize that the police in Minneapolis and Milwaukee are not trained the same way.
Right.
And the way Menominee and Eau Claire police are trained, if you go down to La Crosse, if you go over to Viroqua, if you go even over to Cadott, it is an entirely different set of trainings. And those trainings have consequences. So Eau Claire really has a model police force. How do we talk about what they're doing, and how do we talk about how other communities can use these methods that they're using? But how do you build this trust in the community? Because one of the thread lines through that whole conversation, all of the officers said it over and over again, you have to trust us. And I think my role was to point out, well how do we build that trust? How do we build the trust with the community?
So, Shang Elizabeth Lohr, you've done over 20 episodes of your program, The Social Exchange Project, so far. I have a couple of samples of that at my fingertips. The first is a program you did with Hmong chef Yia Vang. Let's listen in.
It drove me to understand, to go, hey, I want to understand Hmong food. You know, it's the food of our people. It's the food I've been eating growing up. And what we started coining is this phrase that Hmong food isn't a type of food. It's a philosophy of food.
Yeah,
it's a way
totally
of thinking
agree.
About food.
Yeah. I agree about that, too. And so going back to always those roots in the soul of the food that we offer as Hmong people, like my mom right now can literally have the same ingredients as me and not, I can't make it as well as she can. Like her food just tastes like love, you know. And so seeing that your parents inspired you, especially your mom, too, inspire you into getting into this. How did that transition then into you wanting now to do Hmong food?
Yeah.
When you were once not as proud, but now you're so proud.
Yeah. So let's fast forward a couple years. We've been doing this pop-up for a while, and we really felt great about the fact that now we're starting to have a voice for Hmong food, you know. And so every time something you do something, there's always two groups of people, right? They're the people that support you and then the people that criticize. And once a few of the media stuff start hitting, we would get a lot more like critical comments. Mm-hmm. So it's like, oh, you're not really doing Hmong food. You just do a fusion of Mikau and Hmong food. Mm-hmm. You're bastardizing our food just so that, you know, that you can get your name out there. And it's just people we didn't
like
know.
Like that you were a sellout or something?
Yeah.
But
like
you obviously
sellout.
Were not. That was your philosophy of food.
And it's like, oh, like real Hmong food is you got to use this kind of knife. You got to use this kind of board. You got to use this kind of ingredient. You guys aren't doing that. And then I would kind of push back going, well, if you understand Hmong food has always been about whatever region we're in. Because that's what that's the kind of people we are. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We glean from the cultures around us. We glean from the resources
around
us.
We borrow concepts. Yep. We take from around us or borrow from around
yep.
us.
Yep. And then we take that and we forge it into our, you know, to build our own people, you know, and that's what being Hmong is about.
So first, Shang, I have to tell you, I admire your interviewing style. I can understand why your guests feel free to share their feelings. What inspired you to do that show?
Well, that specific episode was actually one of our earlier ones. And Ye Ving has been an inspiration to so many people in our community because he was the very first chef that became mainstream and was recognized for his talents and then putting Hmong food on the map. And what I always say is that food and music connects people regardless of culture and race. And so having someone as important as Ye Ving represent the Hmong people in a dish was incredible. And so I reached out to him. I don't know why he came on my show. He was, I think he was recognized to be like Chef of the Year for Bon Appetit magazine. And so I was just really fortunate and lucky. He's the most humble guy, but the conversation that I wanted to have with him was exactly what we had. I wanted to understand more about his philosophy of life and food and how that relates to his individual background. And his story is very much like many of our stories, you know, the struggles that our parents and grandparents had with the Vietnam War. And, you know, what part of, you know, our history will really translate into our present and our future. And one of the biggest things always was food. You know, we bond over food. Everything, every congregation that we have is always around food. And so having Chef Ye Ving on the show was absolutely one of the best moments, I honestly have to say, on the show, because he just taught me so much more about the uniqueness of what he brings to the table, literally, but also understanding the historical context and the components that our people have contributed to every place that we've been. You know, we always say we didn't really have our own home, our own country. And now it's like, we don't really need that. We have it everywhere. We share and, you know, it's basically a fusion. So
here's another clip from the Social Exchange Project. This one is an interview with Hmong women life coaches. This is an interchange you had with one of your guests, Yang Yi Lor.
So when you think about self-care, think about activities or things that give you energy. So if activities that are taking your energy away,
without
that's not self-care.
It. Yeah.
So
yeah.
Let's say people will say self-care is I'm going to the clubs. No, not if it's draining your energy. That's mm-hmm. not self-care, okay? Going out of town or a night out, okay, could be a self-care if it's charging your energy. But if it's draining you, you're going out every weekend and it's draining you, that's not self-care.
Mm-hmm.
So just notice your energy. I'd say energy is the best defining factor in self-care and work-life yeah. balance. If your energy is low when you get home, you know you're not taking care of yourself.
So being cognizant yes. of what really works for that rejuvenation.
Yeah.
Because how do you fill other people's cups? You mm-hmm. guys are both in the helping field.
Yeah.
You're essentially working with people all day, every day, you yeah. know? And so right. if that's what you're choosing to do as a career, you are essentially helping refill parts of their cup. How do you do it if yours is empty?
Absolutely.
So I love that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In both of the shows that I've been pulling these examples from for the Social Exchange Project, you spent a lot of time talking about the tension between tradition and modern life. Is that a common theme, do you feel, in your program?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that we're still working on, and I wouldn't necessarily say it's like a barrier or a struggle, but you know, just given our historical, our history, my parents and my grandparents and all of ours, really, generationally have always been in survival mode. So we really never stopped to think about mental health and think about what do these concepts mean to us in this generation? Because we don't have to be in survival mode anymore. Not the way our parents and grandparents had to be anyway. And so, you know, shedding light on, you know, Yang Yi Lor, who is an incredible life coach based out of Wausau, having her come in and talk more about life coaching, talking more about self-care, talking more about mental health was huge. And it's, again, modern Hmong topics that I think needs to have more of a platform. You know, I also did a very similar episode, but really focusing on historical trauma with Dr. Ia Zhang. And that was regarding Hmong mental health, which, again, still has a lot of stigmatizing factors to it. And we're still working very hard on what we feel is traditional, quote unquote, like what our parents and grandparents would deem as their values. And now kind of refining what those values mean to us in this generation. So that has always been something that comes up in each of the episodes as I have Hmong guests on.
Our time is tight, and I want to squeeze in a caller. Burl from Eau Claire has joined us. Burl, welcome to the West Side. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. Yes, my question is for either one. I just want to know, in terms of looking at our community, we know that imprinting is a big issue. Many people don't understand exactly what it means in terms of inherent biases and racism and things of that nature. But I wonder from the guests, what are your perspectives on how do we teach the Eau Claire community that these types of biases exist and that there is a certain amount of imprinting that each has had that basically helps to delay the opportunities of minorities to have equal opportunities or equal treatment in our community?
Salika, you want to jump in on that one?
Yes. Because Conversations in Color is meant to oppose those implicit biases, to oppose that imprinting. And I know that the Social Exchange Project has done several has done several episodes about it as well. But the entire premise for Conversations in Color is to undermine and offset the social media that we have right now that's reinforcing stereotypes that divide us, that reinforce these media images that are used to sell product or to take money from people's wallets, but that aren't accurate. When we have multicultural people being portrayed as lazy, when we have whites who are married to multicultural people being slandered, when we ignore the special needs of biracial people, we reinforce those stereotypes. So the very existence of these two programs really is meant to offset some of that media bias, some of the imprinting that you're talking about. Now for Conversations in Color, I think we do it much more directly. What Sheng does so beautifully is she has these conversations. And she has these conversations and she creates this safe environment for other people. I mean, listening to the one about food really reminds me that Hmong people and Black people in the United States are both diasporic people. And within that diaspora, we've had to spend so much time surviving. And for people outside our communities to begin to recognize these conversations and to hear these conversations, to see the similarities and to appreciate the differences, undermines the screaming you see on social media, undermines this idea that all people who are multicultural are taking or looking for free stuff. You know, and I think that showing ordinary people is one of the strongest things we can do. Yeah. Leo Bogart, in his work for the U.S. Army in the 1950s during the Korean War, showed that controlled contact offsets stereotypes and offsets confirmation bias. And this is controlled contact. This is when you see Sheng, what you see is a beautiful Hmong woman who is a professional, and she's talking to other professionals. And that offsets the stereotype. when you see Ed and me, Ed is a white Southerner from Virginia, a white Southern man and a black Southern woman who live in the Chippewa Valley. And we're ragging each other, we're razzing each other, but we're having these really hard conversations with people about some topics that if you don't handle them very well, they can hurt people. And I think what Sheng does and what Ed and I do is we model how to have those conversations.
We are up against the clock. How do people, Salika Duxworth-Lawton, how do people find Conversations in Color if they'd like to listen to those episodes? And I encourage people to do so.
Well, we are on Converge Radio. We're also at the Pablo, and we're on YouTube. So if you Google Conversations in Color, Eau Claire, you will get the Pablo link, and you can register for the Pablo link. You can also listen on YouTube on the TuneIn app or digitally, and we hope Converge will be back on the air soon. So then you'll be able to listen on the radio again. We want to be able to stream through the Facebook Tomei Swab and Conversations in Color page. Go to the Conversations in Color page on Facebook. You can find us.
Very good. Sheng Elizabeth Lohr, how about you? The Social Exchange Project, how do people find it?
Yeah, so if you are wanting just the audio, you can go on Spotify or Google Play Music. But I encourage looking at YouTube or Facebook because we do film and have the 4K video quality. So Facebook and YouTube.
And just to point out, the word, it's social and then the letter X and then change if people are searching.
Yes, exactly. It's a play on words, yeah. But it's the social and then the letter X and then change project.
Very good. Sheng Elizabeth Lohr, Salika Duxworth-Lawton, thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you,
thank
Dean.
Thank you.
Coming up, we hear from a longstanding voice of diversity in Western Wisconsin, WOJB Radio. I'm Dean Kallenbach, and this is The West Side on the Ideas Network. Back on The West Side now with our focus on media programming by, for, and about minority populations in Western Wisconsin. We spent the last segment talking with Sheng Lohr of the Social Exchange Project and Salika Duxworth-Lawton of Conversations in Color, some fresh programming that has evolved in the past several months. Our next focus is a media entity that has been part of life in northwestern Wisconsin for most of the past four decades. Radio station WOJB is licensed to the Lacouture Band of Lake Superior Chippewa and broadcasts from their reservation near Hayward. The public affairs manager at WOJB, Eric Schubring, couldn't join us live for a very good reason. He's on the air right now. But I did get a chance to talk to him yesterday about the station and his role in it.
I host the morning program here, and of course, WOJB, since its inception, or almost since the beginning, has been a national public radio affiliate, and we continue to broadcast the morning edition daily, Monday through Friday, and then the weekend edition on the Saturdays as well. And I'm that, Wisconsin public radio affiliates and stations, I'm that voice you hear between the national public radio segments, and then after that, after 8 o'clock, I do essentially an hour of locally originated programs that I originate, and a lot of that has to do with what's happening in this Lacouture community. And for several years, we had been, until this coronavirus pandemic, broadcasting once a week from a native operated coffee shop, not so very far from here, and that hour of programming was, you know, exclusively about the things that are happening, whether it's the school or the health center or tribal government or housing or the variety of the wide variety of services and so-called entities here on the reservation, and talking with Native folks about that. The morning program, you know, we try to include news and events that are occurring here on the res, on the reservation. Later in the day at noon, we broadcast a program called Native America Calling, which includes a national Native news program and a one-hour call-in program that is nationwide. Generally, though, our music programming, which is, it's probably about 50-50 or maybe 60% music, 40% news and information, you know, we try to include a fair amount of Native music, whether it's contemporary or traditional.
WOJB, and again, it's 88.9 FM, a nice big strong signal covering most of northwestern Wisconsin, got its start back in 1982. Can you talk a little bit more about the station's history, but also its mission?
Well, the mission, in fact, I happen to have the mission statement in front of me, and I've often considered my primary goal or mission here is to reflect credit on the Lac-Couturier tribe and the Ojibwe Nation as a whole. But, of course, much of the goal of the radio station at first was to convey the cultural past of the Native people here, the Ojibwe people here. And, of course, in 1982, that predated by only a few years the treaty rights conflict that followed the decision that reaffirmed the rights of the Ojibwe, which is the native people living essentially in the northern third of Wisconsin, to hunt, fish, and gather on all of those lands. And, of course, there was a very controversial and contentious treaty rights controversy in particular because of the spear fishing as a result. And, of course, we were here, the radio station was here to speak to that at that time. And we at the time invited people who were proponents and opponents of the treaty spear fishing. And I think it's safe to say that that really satisfied or really met much of the mission of the radio station, and that was to communicate the history, the culture, tradition, and the truth, if you will, about what these treaties were and the rights that were retained. And that was a very significant time for the radio station and really, as I say, met much of what was the goal of the station, was to communicate, important information about the community. You know, Dean, once upon a time, I'm sure that people rarely heard drum music, traditional drum music, anywhere. And that's, although it's not a part of all of the programming of WOJB, it is here from this radio station that you can hear, the tribal, the traditional, the heartbeat of Mother Earth, the drum of the Ojibwe people and others.
Eric Schubring is the public affairs manager at WOJB Woodland Community Radio, which has been broadcasting for the past 38 years from the reservation of the Lac-Couturier Band of Lake Superior Chippewa in Sawyer County. Coming up, there's an anti-pandemic spread coalition in the River Falls area called Let's Do Our Part, and its latest campaign includes video testimonials from local residents. We hear next from the city's communications manager, Mary Zimmerman. If you'd like to join that conversation, call 800-228-5615. I'm Dean Kallenbach. This is The West Side on the Ideas Network. We're back on The West Side. Since mid-March, each week when we haven't been doing political debates on The West Side, we try to provide at least some update on the coronavirus pandemic as it's affecting western Wisconsin. We've often talked to public health experts or reporters covering this story, but today I'm pleased to welcome the communications manager for the city of River Falls, Mary Zimmerman, who's here today to talk to us about a campaign and a coalition in the community called Let's Do Our Part River Falls. And Mary Zimmerman, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
So much of our experience with COVID-19 in western Wisconsin, from the safer at home orders in April through much of the summer, was that the story was big elsewhere, but locally we just weren't seeing that much of the disease. What's instigated the formation of the coalition for Let's Do Our Part?
Well, it came about in August when we were seeing increase in cases, and also the University of Wisconsin here in River Falls was planning for their students to come back into town and wanted to share some messaging with them. So they had been working on some graphic information, some messaging, and coincidentally at the same time, I was planning to do something similar. So we got in touch with each other and decided, it'd be a good idea to handle this together. So we reached out to a number of other organizations. Now there are 9. And so we're, sharing our unified message and also divvying up the responsibilities.
Now, the newest phase of the Let's Do Our Part River Falls is a series of video testimonials, and I understand they'll be going public soon. Mary Zimmerman, you've been kind enough to preview some of those testimonials, which we'll share in a minute, but what's the goal of the testimonials as part of the campaign?
Well, there are several. One is to kind of communicate the urgency now with the spikes and surges. And also the vaccine is on its way, and that's good news, but it'll take a while before it gets here. So the message is hang on, and it's important to be serious and stay vigilant. We also wanted to focus on different members of the community, faces that people would recognize, and to share their personal stories, their compelling stories. And the ultimate goal is to change behavior for those who haven't been good about it.
Let's hear some samples from those testimonials. First, this is Christy Erickson. She's an emergency room nurse at River Falls Area Hospital, sharing her frustration at seeing careless behavior in the community while she's trying to keep people from dying.
All of us still want to very much be here. We want to take care of the people with COVID. We want to take care of the people without COVID. We want to take care of the people that are here for a broken bone or having a heart attack or having a stroke. Our desire to care hasn't changed. I think it's just a lot of it is the PPE and also the mental stress of our concern for not spreading it, you know, to our families when we go home. Taking care of a COVID person that we intubated or somebody that we know is actively dying because of COVID, and then driving home past an establishment that's packed and you know that there's no social distancing going on in there. People aren't wearing masks. They're close to each other. Probably not a lot of infection prevention things happening at some of these establishments, and you drive past them after you just held the hand of somebody that's dying of COVID or held their hand until you intubated them. It's very frustrating. It's hard to kind of keep a positive attitude when you see those things happening in the community as well as how close this is to home.
That's ER nurse Christy Erickson. Here's another healthcare professional. This is family physician Dr. Rita Raverty from Alina Health's River Falls Clinic.
Some of my most memorable interactions have been with people who don't take this seriously. And it's really hard for all of us emotionally because we have been working hard to keep people well and to help people to recover, and then to be told that this is a hoax or it's a sham or it's not real or it's not serious is really, I guess for me more than anything, it's hurtful. I guess some people are angry about it. For me, it's hurtful. I feel like we spend a lot of time helping people in the community, and I've been asked how much money I'm making off of COVID-19 or if I get paid to fill out death certificates and things that are really hard for me to process. I've been asked if I was going to be happy to go back to my regular clothes and be done with COVID-19 once the election was over. And I was really honestly pretty speechless about that question. And so on one hand, I have a lot of people who are very supportive and are taking this very seriously. But on the other hand, it's frustrating to feel personally attacked while we're working so hard to get our patients and our community through this crisis.
That's the voice of Dr. Rita Raverty from Alina Health's River Falls Clinic. Mary Zimmerman, a number of professionals, a number of the testimonials come from healthcare professionals like the two we just heard from. From those, what are the compelling messages you're hearing beyond what we've heard already from Christy Erickson and Dr. Raverty?
Well, I think one of them, Christy in particular, talked about what it was like to, they have a Monday or a week daily, I think, huddle, she calls it, where they come together and talk about what's been going on with COVID. And she said, you know, at first they had a lot to talk about and there were things going on and they were preparing. And as it drags on and on and on, they're fatigued. They're weary. I think she even said shell-shocked. So that was really compelling to hear. I'm very glad the healthcare community got involved. Actually, the hospital and the clinic were the last to join us just a month ago. And they have said these healthcare workers, the doctors and nurses and others, really wanted to get the word out, really wanted to share their feelings. So I was very happy that we had this opportunity for them to do that. They talk about They talk about having very few ICU opportunities left for COVID patients, that some of the others who are, you know, have other surgeries or heart attacks or other real emergency situations are being sent to, for instance, La Crosse. So that's very difficult when the doctor says he's worried about the nursing shortage because healthcare workers are getting sick. So for me, it really opened my eyes to a lot of these issues you hear about, but to hear them say it in their own words is very compelling.
It's not just healthcare professionals that are included in these testimonials. One that I listened to yesterday was from Father Gerald Harris from St. Bridget Catholic Church in River Falls. I don't have time to play it this morning, but he talked about how his parish can still, you know, participate and still hear and participate in Mass virtually, but that interaction, that one-on-one, that sitting and eating donuts is missing, that fellowship. And I do have time for one more testimonial, and that's part of this Let's Do Our Part River Falls campaign. This one's from the director of the River Falls Convention and Visitors Bureau and Chamber of Commerce, Russ Corpola. He has a message directed toward businesses, including those who are skeptical about the seriousness of the pandemic.
Early on, I much more understood the skepticism, but we've been battling this disease long enough that the science is quite clear. It's real. Thousands of our fellow Wisconsinites and local friends and neighbors are dying. It's overwhelming our healthcare system. And so all we're asking is, as businesses, is that you do your part to keep COVID in check so that businesses can stay open. And it's simple distancing, washing your hands, and wearing a mask.
That's Russ Corpola, Executive Director of the River Falls Chamber of Commerce and Convention and Visitors Bureau. Mary Zimmerman, his is one of at least three testimonials that come from someone who has actually experienced COVID-19 directly, correct?
Correct, that's right.
So that adds a little more interest it would seem it would add some gravity to those comments.
That's right. Two of them had terrible bouts. Russ was a little less so. And I asked them in their testimonials, and hopefully folks can hear those. Obviously, they've been changed by it. It's worse than they thought it was. And now they're opening up and being advocates and, you know, sharing preventative measures with family and friends and staying apart and doing what they should be doing. But it definitely gives them an insight about this disease.
Are these just preaching to the choir? How can these be used to help change opinions about behaviors relating to the prevention of viral spread?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think my mother always says, give an I message, capital I. It's hard when people are sharing their feelings to say your feelings are not legitimate. So I think it's actually the best way to get the point across. Whether it's going to be absorbed or not, it's hard to tell. But I think that sort of their testimonials on top of our coalition, of which there are nine, and working, you know, throughout the community, that those two sort of powerful issues will work in our favor.
And in 5 seconds, how can people find these testimonials?
They can find them starting next week. We're going to send them out sort of one at a time through the next couple of weeks, but they can find them at rfcity.org/letsdoourpart.
Very good. Mary Zimmerman, thank you for joining us. Thanks also to our guests earlier this hour, Eric Shubring of WOJB Radio, Salika Duxworth-Lawton of Conversations in Color, and Sheng Elizabeth Lohr of the Social Exchange Project.